I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, Condoleezza Rice prepares the way for a November Mideast Peace Summit. As she does, an observer warns, don't mistake the Middle East for the former Soviet Union. The Middle East is much more complicated. But first, the nation's largest maker of implanted heart devices is issuing a warning to cardiologists and their patients. Medtronic is telling them that certain types of wires in its implanted defibrillator system can misfire and shock patients or not function when needed. The wires have caused malfunctions in hundreds of patients and may have resulted in 5 deaths. Joining us now, Dr. Robert Hauser, cardiologist at the Minneapolis Heart Institute. He's been in the forefront of research in implanted devices. Dr. Hauser, describe this implanted defibrillator system. This is not a pacemaker, and it's not the external device that you see on TV, you know, clear and then zap. It's implanted. So where and how does it work?
Well, it's implanted usually under the left collarbone. It's a small incision usually done under a local anesthetic, and a wire is threaded into the heart. The device, the defibrillator, monitors the heartbeat, and if a patient is having a dangerous or potentially dangerous rhythm, the pulse generator charges up and then delivers a shock to the heart and usually restores a normal rhythm.
Yeah. Is it painful to be shocked inappropriately? In other words, if, as we hear these wires do, the heart is shocked when it doesn't need it, how does that feel?
Well, it is painful, particularly if you receive multiple shocks at one time.
Well, Medtronic says it's the Sprint Fidelis brand of wires that is the problem. How many patients have them?
Approximately 260,000 worldwide.
And is it because of the flaw in the wires to the heart and not the the defibrillator itself?
It's not in the pulse generator. It is in the wire, and there are two locations, one within the heart and one near the point where the defibrillator is implanted, again under the collarbone.
Well, you've been watching this for a while. Earlier this year, you published research that found a significant number of patients were being shocked by misfiring defibrillators. So, how common is it? We hear 5 deaths possibly, and that, even one would be awful, but how common is it?
It looks like the failure rate is 2-3% in the first 2 to 2.5 years.
Yeah. And given how implants work, is that, obviously that's unacceptable, but, could you put that on a scale?
Well, it's unusual to see this level of failure in patients who have only had their devices for a couple of years. The average lead will fail, if it's going to fail, usually at 5 years or longer. So to see this is unusual.
And by the way, how many people have this?
Well, we don't know exactly how many patients have defibrillators worldwide, but it's estimated to be at about 500,000.
Including some very famous ones. We understand Dick Cheney, who's a 2001 implant recipient, he has different wires, but he has an implant.
That's correct.
Right. Well, what should patients do? And that might have been one of yours calling you right now, but what should patients do if they have these wires?
Well, the first thing they need to do is contact their doctor. The second is get into a surveillance program where their wires are checked on a regular basis, and this may be every month for some and perhaps every quarter for others. There are a number of ways that this can be done. It can be done in the clinic or it can be done on the telephone. We're actually doing it both ways because we think that is the best approach.
Yeah. The New York Times today reports that Medtronic will pay for replacement leads after they've misfired, but they're not going to pay for replacement in patients whose leads haven't misfired yet. Why wait?
Well, obviously you need to ask Medtronic that, mm-hmm. but I would think that it would be appropriate for them to reimburse patients for the extra follow-up that's required to monitor the performance of these leads.
But I'm wondering if there's also a danger in just willy-nilly replacing all the leads.
There is definitely a danger. We are not recommending replacement of a lead unless it's malfunctioning. Mm-hmm. So there is no need to go in and replace a lead which is passing all of the tests.
Yeah. Well, as I said, you've been keeping an eye on this. You were one of the doctors who a few years ago pointed out defibrillator malfunctions, which were kept quiet by a different manufacturer. Do you think that the heart implant industry has maybe learned some lessons in its response this time around?
Well, I think it has. There's much more transparency today than there was even 2 or 3 years ago. And the Heart Rhythm Society has done an excellent job developing guidelines for manufacturers and for the FDA.
Right. And overall, these devices are still, in your mind, well worth it?
Absolutely. They're life-saving devices. Patients should have no reluctance whatsoever to undergo implantation of this device. But like all things made by man, there are issues that come up from time to time, and they simply need to be managed.
Dr. Robert Hauser, cardiologist at the Minneapolis Heart Institute at Abbott Northwestern Hospital in Minnesota. Dr. Hauser, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is in the Middle East today, trying to nudge the Israelis and Palestinians toward the table at a peace conference planned for next month in Annapolis, Maryland. Speaking in Ramallah today, Rice said this is the most serious effort to resolve the conflict in years. But is it? Or is it understood by all parties that this is a symbolic push? And what will Condoleezza Rice's legacy be in 15 months? Will it include an agreement like the Camp David Accord? Well, our next guest says probably not. Journalist David Samuels wrote a lengthy profile of Rice for the Atlantic Monthly. He spent days trailing her while she was on earlier diplomatic missions in the Middle East. He also sat down with her for several interviews. He is at times very complimentary. He calls Rice an extreme person, someone who shook up the stodgy State Department. When we spoke recently, I asked him to start by explaining that.
Condoleezza Rice isn't like anyone that I've ever met before or you've ever met before. She's a unique, diligent, bright, controlled woman who's in extremely good physical condition. She's a concert-quality pianist. She's an expert on the Soviet military. She's a fanatic fan of NFL football. She's also a person who I think really does live to some extent in her own world, and that can be troubling when you look at her as a diplomat trying to solve some of the most intractable problems in the world, particularly when you look at the Middle East, an area where she really doesn't have any depth of knowledge or experience at all, and is trying to do some very big things.
Well, let's talk about that. When you say lives in her own world, she was a Soviet expert. How is that perhaps to her disadvantage in the Middle East?
Former Assistant Secretary of State Dick Armitage told me somewhat unkindly that Condoleezza Rice was an expert in one country that no longer exists, the Soviet Union, when I asked him what he thought of her chances for brokering some kind of Middle East peace agreement. The Middle East is a difficult place. I think America has found out just how difficult and just how complicated Middle Eastern politics can be. Good intentions aren't enough. In fact, any schema that you tend to apply to the Middle East that has good guys or bad guys or things should be this way or that way tends to fall apart pretty quickly when it confronts a very tangled, very deep historical reality that isn't really part of the optimistic Western American narrative about how people are supposed to behave. Condoleezza Rice, as a Soviet expert, really did sit, you know, in a front row seat as the Berlin Wall came down and believes that there's a story that she's part of, which is about the triumph of freedom.
And she's not the only one, we should say. Many others in the White House, including the president, share that view. But you also sat down with her predecessor, Colin Powell, and had an interesting exchange with him about that thinking that, well, as he says, you know, you can substitute Red China and the Soviet Union with terrorism. He says the communists, the fascists, get serious. The few authoritarian regimes that are left around are peanuts. The Cold War is gone. Tell me more about that exchange.
Certainly, if you look at the foreign policy disasters of the first Bush administration, one reason for them is the fact that the president's foreign policy team was so badly divided. Donald Rumsfeld was pursuing a Donald Rumsfeld policy, and Powell was pursuing a Powell policy. And as he told me, he didn't share any of the assumptions people like certainly Dick Cheney and to some extent the president were acting under during that first term.
Well, and he also doesn't agree that you can sort of lift that binary thinking about the good and bad from the Soviet Union and place it as a template over the Middle East. And let's get back to the Middle East because I want to let you complete your thoughts on that because now, of course, Powell and Rumsfeld are gone. And the bureaucratic balance, you say, has shifted in Condoleezza Rice's favor. How does that play out in the Middle East? What do you think the outcome will be?
You know, I think the outcome is that both sides will probably agree on some sort of reasonably vague statement of principles. So the question becomes, you know, what's this conference really about? And I think the answer is it's about window dressing for the American repositioning in the Middle East. It's a way of showing people, yes, you know, the Bush administration cares about Israel and Palestine, and we're on the side of justice, and we're trying to get a deal done. Now, please help us out in Iraq.
But you write also that it's, you know, being pushed by other Arab countries who are saying, if you don't at least even do window dressing, we're all doomed.
That's right. I don't think that anybody really wants an Israeli-Palestinian peace. I mean, think of the Saudis, right? If there was an Israeli-Palestinian peace, the Saudis would be called on to guarantee it. They face a powerful opposition within their own country, a significant al-Qaeda threat to the Saudi regime. If you see the king of Saudi Arabia standing on the White House lawn and signing a document in which the Palestinians and recognize the right of Israel to exist and accept, you know, 25% of historic Palestine as their country, that's the betrayal that Osama bin Laden has been waiting. You know, here's a picture of it. It's all happening just like he said it would. The Saudis, I think, are the last people who want to be seen publicly backing any kind of deal like that. So I think that while people pretend that this is a desirable end, what people really want is the appearance of some kind of action without an actual deal.
Condoleezza Rice as well?
I think she'd say that, you know, when history is ripe for there to be an agreement, there will be an agreement. And so the historical process itself will produce an Israeli-Palestinian peace agreement, you know, if and when it's time for an Israeli-Palestinian peace agreement. So I think in some sense, she doesn't believe that what she does there is all that significant, as opposed to Bill Clinton, who believed that he really was going to make something happen. Of course, he failed to make something happen. So, you know, you can choose between which of those two approaches is more productive or least dangerous.
How much is Condoleezza Rice perhaps to blame for the situation in the Middle East with Fatah in one territory, Hamas in another, in Gaza? You write that she was the one who pushed for elections in the region against the advice of others. She was shocked and surprised when Hamas won.
Condoleezza Rice made a, you know, terrible blunder by pushing for elections. I was in Gaza at the time, and it was obvious to me that Hamas was going to win the elections there, at least, as they did. And I think it was obvious to everybody who was there, simply if you counted the number of flags and looked at the number of people at rallies and saw how despised Fatah was.
How much of her thinking going into those elections in the Middle East were because of, you know, as you've explained, that sort of Soviet-era thinking that this faith in democracy means if they only had the opportunity, we are sure they will choose the right path?
The rise of Ronald Reagan and the fall of the Soviet Union, I think, really did bring about a revolution in the Republican Party. And you had these people who embraced the idea that, you know, history was on the side of freedom. History was on the side of democracy. I think that became very prevalent sort of consciously and sort of subconsciously for people. I don't think Condoleezza Rice started off that way when she was a young Soviet expert in the 80s. But I think that she got a little bit of that true religion, and she and a lot of people sort of carried that sense with them that, you know, if you bet on democracy, if you bet on historical progress, you're going to come out on the winning side just like Ronald Reagan did. And I think there was a lot of that going into the Iraq War, and that way of looking at the world certainly manifested itself in the American approach to the Palestinian problem and lots of other problems around the world. And I think, you know, events have been showing just how shallow that kind of thinking is.
That's journalist David Samuels. We'll go broader when we come back. Let's look at Iran. Who really is dictating White House policy in Iran? Is it Rice or Vice President Dick Cheney? Back in 1 minute, here and now. We're back with more of our conversation about Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. Journalist David Samuels profiled Rice in the Atlantic Monthly. We spoke to him before her latest shuttle diplomacy trip to the Middle East. She's trying today to set the stage there for a planned Middle East conference in the U.S. next month. I asked David to comment on what analysts have been saying about the dynamic within the Bush administration in its final months in office, that there is this tug of war between Vice President Dick Cheney and Secretary of State Rice, and that Rice is winning, that she's now the moderating voice on foreign policy, specifically on what to do about Iran's nuclear program.
First of all, I'd like to say that I don't really buy a lot of these schemas that have Rice as the moderator, Cheney as the hardliner. I think this does go back to the first term where authentically Powell and Rumsfeld did believe very different things. and Bush sort of sat there and listened to them fight it out. I don't think that's true now. I think Cheney and Rice have a good working relationship, so I don't think that there's the same kind of divisions that there were in the first term, and I think a lot of that talk is sort of a good cop, bad cop routine that the administration puts out there.
As to the second question, though, looking at Iran, is Condoleezza Rice looking at it differently because of the recent experiences?
Yeah, I don't think that anyone at this point would bet 2 cents on the possibility of an American invasion of Iran.
You don't, because, we hear that drumbeat.
The drumbeat's there just to get people to move. I think that all of this is diplomacy. The use of force may be the failure of diplomacy, but the threat of force is an essential part of diplomacy, and I think that that threat is being used towards a diplomatic end, the idea of shaking the Iranian regime and seeing what's possible. I think the reality, though, is that the Bush administration doesn't have that much time left on the clock, and everybody knows it, so why deal with them?
Well, we're looking at what Condoleezza Rice's legacy is. Is part of that legacy North Korea?
We don't know what's going on in North Korea. I mean, we know that North Korea, recently we heard about the Israeli Air Force taking out some kind of nuclear site in Syria. Supposedly that site, had some kind of material or missiles that came from North Korea. Part of the legacy of this North Korean deal may be widespread proliferation of everything that North Korea had throughout the Middle East. We don't know because North Korea is such a shuttered place, what they've agreed to, what's going on there. We haven't seen any results. We know that in these six-party talks, there's the announcement that there's an agreement in principle on terms that we could have had 5 years ago. Now, whether that agreement is serious, whether the North Koreans will carry it out, what's going to come out of there, we don't know. I do think, by the way, cutting against some of what I've said, that a lot of people try to hold Condoleezza Rice responsible for all the failures of the Bush administration simply because she was National Security Advisor during the first term and she's now Secretary of State. So she's sort of a figure who's provided a lot of continuity, and so why not sort of lay it all at her feet?
In fact, former Bush administration official David Kaye, who was charged with finding, the weapons after the Iraq invasion, called Condoleezza Rice probably the worst national security advisor since the office was created. He said this in Bob Woodward's State of Denial book.
Yeah, and he's not the only one who holds that opinion or who has expressed that opinion directly to me. I do think that it's unfair in that there were 3 people in the Bush administration in the first term, all big-time Washington titans, Colin Powell, Dick Cheney, and Donald Rumsfeld, who sort of divided the world between them. Condoleezza Rice wasn't brought in there to be a fourth titan, and she was in no way their equal. She was brought in there to sort of sit at the president's side and give him background on what these guys were saying and sort of write it all up on a sheet of paper when they were done arguing it out so he could make a decision. I think that there's a lot of people who say, well, she should have stepped in. She should have said something. That wasn't her job. Worst national security advisor in history assumes that she had the same power, say, that Henry Kissinger had under Nixon, which I think is clearly absurd.
Well, and on the other hand, if she gets too much blame there, does she get too much credit? GQ magazine ranks her the most powerful person in Washington. Forbes has twice ranked her the world's most powerful woman. Time magazine listed her one of the world's most influential people 4 times. Do you agree with that?
She's clearly influential. She's very close to President Bush. We don't know who else he listens to. We assume he listens to Dick Cheney. Of those, Condoleezza Rice is the one who's the woman. And if Bush is the most powerful man in the world and she's one of his 2 closest advisors, I guess that makes her the most powerful woman in the world. She's also a formidable person. She's an important public presence. She's the face of the United States abroad. We don't see much of Dick Cheney anymore. We didn't see much of him to begin with, but now he's, maybe in that bunker for all we know. And Bush hasn't been that visible either. I think that there's a sense that she should be up front because she's the most popular member of the administration, and the fact that she's a woman and the fact that she's black, softens the idea that maybe a bunch of white guys are running around the world and trying to blow stuff up. And, she is a thoughtful person. She's a bright person, and she has a lot of good qualities. And so she's she's certainly a good choice for a public face.
But as she prepares to exit the office, on the list of what Condoleezza Rice accomplished as Secretary of State will be what?
Right now, the answer is nothing. I don't think she's accomplished a damn thing. I do think that her answer to that is that history will judge what I've accomplished. And there's a lot of invocation of history. And, you know, in some sense, it's a coward's answer. You know, only God can judge me. It's what they get in those prison tattoos. You know, history will judge. Well, we can judge right now that a bunch of things went wrong, you know. On the other hand, there's some truth to it, too. These have been historic times. There have been world-shaking events. You know, I think any smart, thoughtful person can certainly come up with ways that the invasion of Iraq was a terrible disaster and ways in which it could turn out to be a good thing if this happened or that happened. The same is true with Iran. And, you know, maybe the Israelis and Palestinians will sign a peace accord. I think it's all kind of unlikely. But on the other hand, we're talking about big events that took a long time to get the way they are and will take a long time to play out. And so, you know, that's her legacy.
David Samuels, regular contributor to The Atlantic Monthly. His profile of Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice appeared in the June issue. David, thank you.
Thank you so much, Robin.
And tomorrow on Here and Now, China's power elite are meeting in Beijing to anoint future leaders of the Communist Party. Might a future president also have been a protester in Tiananmen Square so many years ago? And still ahead today, a celebrity chef explains how do you prepare meals for hundreds in just hours. We'll talk to Robert Irvine, host of Dinner Impossible. That's all after the news, Here and Now. You've heard, no doubt, about the current home mortgage crisis. Homeowners encouraged to borrow way over their heads in order to own a home, now getting slammed by increased payments and subsequent debt. Or people borrowing money against the value of their homes. As the home price went up, they'd borrow more money. But now home values are dropping and they owe more money than their properties are worth. Well, that same sort of borrowing free-for-all that fueled the mortgage crisis could lead to a meltdown of Wall Street's main independent investment banks. That's according to our next guest. Jerry Eisinger wrote about this looming financial crisis in the November issue of Condé Nast Portfolio Magazine. Jesse, can you explain what's happened with these investment banks that have borrowed up to, what, 30 times their net worth?
What's happened is over the last 5 years or so, the business model for investment banks has changed, and it's entailed taking on a lot more risk than they ever used to do it. And they made a lot of bets with their own money instead of the usual business in the late 90s of standing in the middle of two people that wanted to trade or giving advice to companies that wanted to merge. That was a safe business. It was a very lucrative business, but the returns weren't as great, and the competition was really eroding that business. So what they've done instead is started to make big bets, run their own hedge funds, their own private equity firms, internal to the banks, and then they made big bets with their own money, and they've run up a huge amount of leverage. Leverage is a scary, complicated term for most people, but I think most homeowners understand that. It's when you buy a $1 million house, you put down 20%. The 20% is your net worth or your equity, that $200,000. You borrow $800,000 from the bank, and you're levered at 5-to-1. So what that means is if the house loses 20%, your equity is wiped out. Same problem with the investment banks. Some of them are levered. Bear Stearns is levered 30-to-1. That means that if you have your assets decline by merely about 3-3.5% or so, your equity gets wiped out.
Because they have so much more borrowed money. You mentioned Bear Stearns, the other of the five independent investment banks. Again, these are investment banks, not your regular checking and savings banks, but investment banks. The five are Bear Stearns, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, Lehman Brothers, and Merrill Lynch. They've got, you know, far less equity than they've got all this money that they've borrowed to make further investments. What's the danger of that?
Well, the danger is that they may have gotten overextended. The problem is that when they've made all these investments with their own capital, they've done it in increasingly arcane and complicated areas. Over the last 5 years, there's been a huge rise in, I think everybody knows the term derivatives, but very few understand what it means. But they're complex financial instruments that derive their value from securities like stocks and bonds and currencies. And so they're very hard to value. So what's happened is the investment banks have a bunch of assets on their balance sheets now in these complex derivatives. It's very hard for them to know exactly how much they're worth. They don't trade very much. Exxon stock trades every single day, so you know exactly what Exxon stock is worth on the stock market. But these don't trade, and so you have to use internal complicated financial models to figure out what they're worth. And if they're off by a little bit, their equity would get wiped out. The bad part of this is that they trade with huge numbers of investors, Fidelities of the world, hedge funds, other banks. And so if they go under or have a serious problem, then all those transactions need to be unwound, and that could lead to a real problem, a real crisis in the marketplace.
Well, people do want to know, how does this affect me, these investment banks borrowing all this money and then making investments in, you know, as you said, maybe arcane things and maybe having a crisis. How does that affect the average person?
Well, it's not like the savings and loan down the street where you want it, you put your money in, then you can't get it out, and it's got to be federally insured. So nobody needs to make a run on Goldman Sachs. The problem is that if there's a hiccup at one of these banks stand in the middle of the global financial system, and that could lead to a problem, a less willingness to lend, which could really slow down economic growth.
Well, Jesse, let me ask you, I'm going to use some movie analogies to get at this. It sounds as if this is the Wizard of Oz. Like, you know, there are people behind curtains frantically, you know, pulling levers. They're working with money that isn't theirs, that they are way overextended, that, you know, they've borrowed too much, a lot like, as we've said, we've seen in the housing crisis. But then, you know, you look over at Jimmy Stewart and It's a Wonderful Life and you say, isn't that the way banks always work? That it really wasn't really your money. It wasn't money that was there. It was being used to, you know, build somebody else's company. So why is this overextension by these investment firms, you know, worse now than it might have ever been?
Well, you're absolutely right that these things go, the global economy functions on faith and trust. And the reason why this is bad now is that we had a huge lending boom over the last several years in all areas of global finance, in currencies, in bonds, in stocks, in companies, in emerging markets, in gold. Almost everything that you can think of, people have been investing and bidding up to big to high valuations. Of course, we're familiar with real estate, but it wasn't just real estate. And so now we're looking at what could be the hangover from that. And if the hangover will be okay if everyone retains faith in the lending institutions. But if the lending institutions really run into problems, then that's a much more significant issue for the global economy.
So if you were, let's say, planning on having a job at that new high-tech company that was going to need some investment money to get started, that's where it may hit you in the pocketbook. Just one example of how it may affect someone personally if that loan gets cut to that new high-tech company.
Absolutely. Over the next couple of years, there's going to be a lot less willingness to lend at generous terms and less willingness to give money to riskier ventures. The economy is already slowing down, and we're close to a recession, and a recession would hurt the investment banks. It's not that the investment banks are causing the recession, but the economy is in a precarious state, and anything that would affect the investment banks could have a spillover into the economy because, as you said very perceptively, a lot of this is about perception and trust and willingness to continue to trade and borrow with a partner. And if you don't trust the partner, you lose faith in the partner's ability to pay you back. That affects the global economy and makes you much less willing to trade and borrow and lend.
Jesse Eisinger, his article, Wall Street Requiem, is in the November issue of Condé Nast Portfolio Magazine, speaking about a possible meltdown in independent investment banks. Jesse, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And just a reminder as we get our ducks in a row for the week ahead, you can listen to Here and Now stream live at our website, here-now.org. For past programs, just click on the archives. And you can always download a podcast for free. Take us with you wherever you go. That's here-now.org. And before we go today, from stir-fried bamboo shoots for the Prince of Wales to an inaugural ball for 4,000 guests in just hours, we'll trace the culinary career of the chef behind Dinner Impossible. You're listening to Here and Now.
Sharon, how you doing? Sharon, what's happening? Sharon, how's it going? What's up?
The greeting card industry is about to get some tough competition. Management consultant Dave Hui has found a way to outsource greetings to India. And he joins us now with more. Dave, welcome.
Hi.
You created something called Taj Tunes, a website that sells phone telegrams sung by who?
People in India.
People in India. How does it work? How does the process work? Tell us, yeah.
Taj Tunes is a website that sells singing telegrams delivered over the phone. So you would place your order online, and our singers in India will call your friend. They'll sing a live song on your behalf, and then afterwards they'll actually email you a digital recording of that phone conversation. That way you can listen to both the song as well as your friend's reaction.
How did you get people in India to sing phone messages?
Well, these people I actually hired as an experiment to see how much of my personal life I could outsource.
Like, so things like what? What were you asking them to do?
Many administrative tasks to do errands online or over the phone, such as researching for me unique gifts for Christmas or calling customer service in the airlines.
How did you find these people to do it in India?
I visited India a couple years ago to study outsourcing. And that realizing that outsourcing is just a huge part of everything that we do, I went online to see how much of my personal life I could outsource. And I found a couple companies online that just offer administrative assistance. They call them actually remote executive assistants overseas.
And so how much did you outsource? And we are a family program. I mean, how much did you get people to do?
A good amount. I had to do a lot of learning in the beginning to see what was outsourceable and what wasn't.
What is and what isn't? What'd you find? Give us an example.
I'd say a lot of tasks that are fairly well structured and that are repeatable work well. For instance, one thing I had them do was to call me every morning at 6:30 to give me a wake-up call and read me the top news headlines of the day as well as a daily weather report.
Radio would be cheaper, wouldn't it, Dave? But, again, your experiment continues. So at one point, a friend of yours, I understand, says to you, gosh, you know, what are you going to outsource your friends? And you decide what?
And I said, just to see how far I could take this outsourcing business, I asked them to call my friend on my behalf to wish her happy birthday. And what they did is they called her and they sung her a song, and she got a kick out of it. So I started sending these singing telegrams to all of my friends, and it brought them so much joy. And we thought this was so entertaining that we had to make this available for the general public.
So that brings us back to Taj Tunes, again, your website where people can order greetings. Let's listen to a happy birthday song that someone asked for someone named Andrew.
Hey, Andrew, it's your birthday. Hair?
Check.
Shoes?
Check.
Shades?
Check.
Hey, it's your birthday.
Woo! Woo!
Andrew, you look very good.
Woo! Woo!
You can be in Hollywood.
Okay. Who writes the songs?
We have three composers that we've hired in the Boston area. I think two of them actually went to Berklee School of Music.
We understand Thomas Chan is a composer from Quincy. He is one of them. And who are you finding buying them?
We're getting orders from around the states from all sorts of people, but we tend to attract many young professionals, people in their 20s and 30s, one who are familiar with ordering something online, but also who are looking for just a new form of entertainment.
Well, there's all sorts of varieties. Let's listen to a thank you song of the chorus.
Thank you for all the things you do. Thank you for being a friend, that's true. For turning my gray skies to blue. Thank you for being you.
What do the Indians tell you about this? I mean, do they at all feel silly doing this work for you? Or
they said that this is actually their favorite activity in the workday. I think it's something fun for them to do. They put a lot of energy towards it, and it's a different activity for them. And That's why they like it.
How much does someone pay to get a song?
Each song costs $5.
Okay. How many hits have you had? How many have you done so far?
We just started this past month, but we've gotten a few hundred orders in just the past few weeks.
Dave Hui is founder of Taj Tunes. For more, by the way, you can go to our website, here-now.org. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Okay, quick. Think quick. You've got just a few hours to put on a wedding for thousands. That's what Robert Irvine will do next. After break, here and now. As any chef or caterer can tell you, putting on a formal event, let's say a wedding, can take months of planning meetings, days of food preparation. Or if you're Chef Robert Irvine, 10 hours. That's all he was given to put on a wedding dinner. Here's an excerpt from his TV show, Dinner Impossible.
Good morning, Robert. This afternoon in a church in Princeton, New Jersey, Paula and Fred will marry. This evening at the historic Knowlton Mansion in Philadelphia, their closest friends and family will gather for their long-anticipated wedding reception. Your special skills are urgently required. From this point on, you'll have just 10 hours to prepare 1,000 hors d'oeuvres and a sit-down dinner for 200.
As you can hear, Dinner Impossible is the television and film series Mission Impossible applied to food. Robert is given just hours to prepare some impressive meal in a kitchen he's unfamiliar with helpers he may or may not know, and they may not know their way around a stove. What would bring a chef to put himself through this kind of torture on a regular basis? Cooking is hard enough. He's now written a book, Mission Cook, with recipes and memories of his life in the kitchen. And Chef Robert Irvine joins us from the studios of WBEZ in Chicago. Welcome.
Hi, welcome. Thank you very much for having me.
We have to begin by saying, as we were trying to schedule this interview, we couldn't pin you down. You were like the guy in Mission Impossible. He's in Tampa, he's in South Carolina, and in Chicago. This is a crazy life.
It's a great life. You know, I don't know many chefs that have the opportunity to travel the way I do and meet some great people. And yes, it was an exciting time. We were going to be in South Carolina, and here we are in Chicago.
So. Well, you know, I'm not sure many chefs would want this, because just doing an event that you're well aware of is stressful enough. I mean, we've done a lot of we're sort of foodies here, and we've done stories about, you know, the stress of being in the kitchen. Tell us some of the situations you've been in.
We were 9 miles off the coast of the Bahamas, where we had 4 hours to catch dinner for 20 Bahamian VIPs. We've been in Ice Palace in Quebec City in minus 11 degrees.
You were cooking for 60 people there, and we understand the difficulty was you couldn't cook inside the ice hotel because it would melt.
Right, exactly. And then we've done an inaugural ball with 17 hours for 4,000 people, but then have to move it 3 miles and serve two separate dinners with a couple of hours between them.
Where was that?
That was in Pennsylvania for the Governor Rendell for his inaugural ball, his second term.
Some other situations that I can think of. You had to prepare a meal to be served during a seventh-inning stretch of a baseball game. Do you remember, by the way, the teams, the players?
Oh, absolutely. White Sox and the Yankees.
As we in Boston know, games don't often go according to schedule. I mean, if it had been a no-hitter, whoops, suddenly you're having – I mean, you can't time when the seventh inning is going to come.
Well, I can tell you, I don't know much about baseball, period. So I had a young man by the name of Ron Kittle who was supposed to tell me what was going on. And he kept telling me, one man down, one man out, one. And I'm, what are you talking about? Give me time frames. Well, I can't give you time frames. And that was the whole 2 hours to feed 200 people with ballpark food.
Well, you had to make dinner for a university president and a messy fraternity house with frat boys as helpers. You did a party for Fashion Week with two models as helpers. They didn't really know what they were doing.
No clue.
but let's talk about the wedding meal that you prepared. Here's a little bit of your conversation with the bride and groom.
So how long have you been planning this wedding?
A year and a half.
A year and a half?
You know, food is a big part of our life. If there's one thing I would have said was a disappointment on the menu,
she
is that we didn't have a meat. You know, I'm a guy.
We're nervous, I'm not gonna lie. But, well, I am.
And you give me 10 hours.
Sorry.
To do this.
Right. Did you ever think, oh my God, this might not work?
I think that, to be honest with you, Robin, every time we do one of these shows. You know, the reality is I don't find out anything about it until I get the plane ticket or I get a car to take me there. I don't sleep the night before, and because I don't know what I'm going to get into. I don't know if there is food there, whether there's equipment, or if the equipment works, how many people we're going to feed. So it's a constant battle, and I feel there is a point in the day as we go along through the show that I either know it's going to work or I really think it's not going to work. And up until probably 3 hours out from the time they've given me, I feel it's never going to work. A lot of the preparation is the key to it, you know, organizing the people to get things done. Now, you have to understand there's not a lot of people that work with us that are technical. So, yes, they can peel things and chop things, but they're not very technical to be able to cook. So there's a lot of pressure there on not only me, but then people who I draft in to help me.
Bridal party comes at 6 o'clock. We're pushing it a bit close. We've got to speed up a little bit. How long on that asparagus? Listen, you've got to make sure they're peeled. Don't give me garbage, guys. You get it back.
People can learn from watching you. There's one moment where you have dozens, it seems, of chicken breasts spread out on a table, and you cover the whole thing with this huge, you know, yards and yards of saran wrap, and then you just mallet all everything to get it, you know, flat enough to cook with. And I'm thinking, oh, that's an interesting way to approach a large number of chicken breasts. But, you know, it seems as if food shows have gone from Julia Child showing you just how to fillet something for an hour to these extravaganzas. Do you think people watch the show just to bite their nails along with you, or to learn about cooking?
Well, I think the natural demographic of Food Network, for example, used to be from sort of 18 to, you know, 53-year-old, predominantly female. Dinner Impossible has literally changed that whole scope. It's gone from a 4-year-old to an 84-year-old, and the demographic is very much male-oriented. It's kind of 60-40 male. And I think that's because young children see it as the action hero type of James E. Bond, dressed in black, drives a cool car and cooks. But it's really gone to a male audience who say, you know, it's okay to cook. It's not feminine to cook.
And just a little bit about you. Is it true you were discovered by Prince Charles?
That is correct, yes, when I was 15 years old.
Doing what?
I was in the Royal Navy at the age of 15. The year was 1980. The electric wok from Tefal first came out, and I was one of the first people to get one of them.
With the electric wok.
Yes, yes. You know, the plug-in and the
right.
dial on it.
Right.
Well, I was one of the first people to get that, and my boss said to me, here's a recipe book, figure it out. Well, you can imagine a young 15, scrawny-year-old little boy with a white T-shirt and his name stamped on the left-hand side, being in Her Majesty's Royal Navy. I said, okay, figure it out. Well, my first customer that day was the Prince of Wales, unbeknown to me, because I didn't know who he was. He came to my table and said, well, what are you cooking, chef? Well, first of all, he called me chef, you know, and I just finished 6 weeks of basic training. Secondly, I said, well, I don't really know. I've just got this book and, you know, it tells me to do this and this. He said, well, make me something. So I actually made him something. He ate it. He came back and said, that was wonderful.
What was it?
It was just bamboo shoots. It was almost like a concoction of just things. You know, there was no name to it because we'd literally just got the book. So he was almost like my guinea pig. And we did that for 3 months. Every day he came in for 3 months and ate what was supposedly the same dish, which never the same because we kept adding different things to it. He left 2 weeks after that. I left, went to meet him in Buckingham Palace, and then I left the following week on board the Royal Yacht Britannia, and the rest is kind of history, which is in the book.
That's Chef Robert Irvine, and the book is Mission Cook, My Life, My Recipes, and Making the Impossible Easy. It's written with Brian O'Reilly. He can also be seen, as we've been saying, in Dinner Impossible, Wednesday nights on the Food Channel. Robert Irvine, thank you so much.
You're welcome. It's been fun.
For more on Robert Irvine, including recipes, go to our website, here-now.org. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Tamagawa, Alex Ashlock, and Virginia Prescott. Doug Sugars is our engineer, our web producer, Ken George, our intern, Jill Ryan. Our managing editor is Chris Ballman. The senior producer of Here Now is Kathleen McKenna. I'm Robin Young. I just feel I should await my orders now to go on some sort of mission. Please join us again, Here and Now.
You can listen to Here and Now live each weekday at noon Eastern Time by going to WBUR.org and clicking on the Listen Live button. You can also find us each weekday at noon Eastern on XM Radio Channel 133.
Five. funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.